And we'll say good evening and welcome back to Decisions of Fate and to our fourth and final lesson, Lesson 4, The Body's Dignity. So, it's been a wonderful ride so far. Very specific, of course, medical ethics, but it's been a fascinating journey, certainly for me, and I hope for all of you as well. But before we launch in, first a story. So there was a fellow who, the UJA of Pittsburgh was after for a long time. But this guy wouldn't budge. But they didn't stop, and they kept their eyes on him. Of course, this would be a potential donor to the Jewish Federation in Pittsburgh. Eventually, they didn't know what would their next move should be, but they came up with an idea that they're going to invite this fellow to a five-day trip to Israel. And it's going to be five-star, and they're going to offer it to him, and he actually agreed. He said he'll take them up. So the top leaders of the local Jewish Federation were preparing to go to Israel with this fellow, and they asked him, tell us what you need to make your trip more convenient and the best possible. And he said, I don't need much, but I do want to take my dog. And they said, you know what? We're going to get you a dog pack. And they got him the absolute best one. They spent a ton of money on it, knowing that it will all come back. And that's what they used. Anyway, they ventured onto the journey, and he went out to baggage claim immediately. They were dealing with the baggage, and suddenly they get the luggage. They also get the dog pack. They open it up, and they see Yitkadal v'Yitkadash Shemei Rabba. The dog is gone. And they didn't know what to do. This is the highlight, and this is the one request that he had. Anyway, they immediately told him that there was some backup and some of the luggage got stuck in Chicago and whatever. So that way he can continue on his journey. And they're going to take care of it. Immediately, they got some locals onto the case, and they put out a request on social media with a picture of the dog. And they said they need an identical dog to this dog. There's no way they can tell this to the owner of the dog. And they put it out across the country. Until the next morning, somebody from Be'er Sheva comes forward. He says, I have the twin brother of that dog. They paid him top dollar. They took his dog, and they made their way to the King David Hotel with the dog to their friend, to his owner. And they come to the eighth floor of the King David. They bring it in. We have your stuff. All happy. And he takes it. He opens it up. And this dog is barking and jumps out of the dog pack, and the guy faints. And they revive him, and they say, what's going on? He couldn't even speak. He said, a miracle. I brought my dog to bury in Israel. Just arriving to Israel, and my dog was revived from the dead. So, with that, sometimes things are best left untouched, right? So we're going to launch in tonight. Of course, we're going to open with a case study. And the case study relates to the use of unclaimed bodies for medical training. So we're going to start on page 118 in your books. And we're not going to read the whole thing. We're just going to read the first chunk. Octavia, would you be okay reading for us?
Sure.
And I'll stop you after about five paragraphs. Take it away.
Okay. In the anatomy lab at the University of North Texas Health Science Center at Fort Worth, medical students interact with what some consider their very first patients, dead people who, more often than not, chose to donate their bodies to science through the school's Willed Body Program. They provide the repetition that leads to confidence for students who will one day treat living patients. But about 1 in 4 cadavers belong to those the county calls unclaimed, people whose families couldn't afford or chose not to provide funeral services, or those whose next of kin couldn't be found. Not only has the program saved Tarrant County hundreds of thousands of dollars in its first 3 years alone, it's provided a more diverse donor pool from which students can learn. Texas law requires each county's commissioner's court to care for the bodies of people who can't afford funeral arrangements. An attorney general opinion in 2000 noted the language allows the county to donate the body to a medical facility. Before contracting with the Health Science Center, Tarrant County offered burials or cremations at no cost to the person's family. According to Lisa Martin, director of the Tarrant County Department of Human Services, the expenses cost the county roughly $500,000 each year. After the contract went into effect, those expenses plummeted. The county mostly stopped offering burials, the most costly option, though exceptions for unidentified bodies, veterans, and people with certain religious beliefs remain.
Okay, you can pause right there. We won't read the rest. I think we got the gist of it, and that is our question that we were going to be tackling. Should unclaimed bodies be allowed for use for anatomical dissection? That's the question. And for starters, I would love to hear opinions from all of you if these unclaimed bodies are, if it's okay, if it's, I would love to hear arguments for and against the use of these unclaimed bodies for this purpose. Yes, Nick?
I have a question before I give you my opinion. Is there anything in Jewish law that forbids an autopsy?
Well, first I want your opinion, then I'm going to give you the Jewish law.
I don't know. And usually I'm Mr. Opinion, but I really don't have much data to, I don't know how to judge that.
Well, maybe you'll hear some other opinions and that will help you.
Yes,
you say you're for it. So you're saying it's okay to use them?
Yes.
Instead of burying them, okay?
Without knowing the answer to the question that was posed earlier, I feel like there very likely are faiths out there that would forbid that. So you may be doing in death something that would be abhorrent to a person, and I have a problem with that.
So you're saying in the case that one of these people was religious, of whatever religion, that may have an issue with it, so you don't want to take that chance of going against the will of that person's wishes. Okay, that's fair. Anybody else? So far we have a for and against, so whatever you say, you won't be alone.
No.
You're against. What's your argument?
You ought to know.
It's in keeping with Tzelem Elohim. It's a body that is given God, and it shouldn't be desecrated.
For medical purposes.
You know, it's not as if the person themselves said, I want to donate my body. It's the person is dead. Can't make a decision.
Okay. That is fair.
Okay, so as a counter argument to that, if the medical facility has a patient with no known relatives, they get that person's permission to donate, then I don't have a problem with
okay,
that.
Excellent point. So you're saying, so this wouldn't be an unclaimed body,
well,
then? It would be a different situation.
Because it may not have any relatives.
Right, but then. But that was the plan. That would have been the original plan. It wouldn't be that they're just nobody's. Right. Okay. Anyone else want to share anything?
Well, you know, when I was a medical student, we were still using cadavers. It's not that common anymore. So I always had a problem with it, though, when it was someone who died and didn't give consent. And so
I'm just curious.
You just knew as a generality that this happened, that some mm-hmm. bodies were. I don't think you knew which cadaver was and wasn't consent, but you knew some were. So, because this was...
But you mean unclaimed? They were unclaimed?
That they were unclaimed and no consent, and there was, let's say, uh-huh. someone died on the street homeless and nobody knew any family and nobody came by, which is, I assume, is what we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would say, at this point in my life, I would say no.
Nick, got a customer for you. Okay, let's take a look here. So arguments for and against. We have first, someone at the door, Nick. Sorry to bother. So let's say the four arguments would be number one. Number one, we have unclaimed bodies are a burden on the public purse. So this is one reason, as we noted, it costs them about $500,000 a year. And like this, that would be able to be addressed. Number two, they alleviate the shortage of cadavers for research and study, and they're needed. They're needed, so that they would provide for this need. In addition to the financial thing, which is not a huge issue, but it's something. On the flip side, the arguments against would be, it is unethical to use a body without consent, as was mentioned. Hello, Ori. And secondly, another argument against would be that the poor are being exploited for the benefit of society. And by the way, there is a racial component to this argument as well, because some people say that because unclaimed bodies are disproportionately black or other racial minorities, so that's a reason against of not to take advantage. But on the flip side, that also serves an argument for, because most of the people that voluntarily donate their bodies are white, which means that there's a lack of practice being done on bodies of minorities, which of course various different groups or races have different diseases that may be more dominant in one group or another, and it actually is helpful to have more information and more studying and more knowledge. So I'm just throwing that in because that's a component to this discussion as well. So the question here is about utilizing unclaimed bodies for the purpose of medical education, and we had two arguments for and two arguments against. All right, so with that, let's advance, and we'll begin our analysis of Jewish sources regarding autopsy with the following Talmudic passage. Being that we, Len, please, the first, the text number one on page 123, straight out of the Talmud.
One who transports human bones on a donkey may not place them in the leather saddlebag and ride on top of them, for by doing so, one treats them disrespectfully.
Thank you very much. So apparently back then there was this I don't know, custom or thing that was done, that they first buried a body and then maybe waited for I don't know, the skin to basically for it to come down to just bones, and then they would rebury it in its final resting place elsewhere. So if these are being transported from one place to another, this is what the Talmud, this law is telling us, that if you are transporting bones, you cannot just put them on the donkey and sit on top of them, because that would be disrespectful. I mean, of course, if they're in a bag or whatever it is, or even a small coffin, it would be disrespectful to be sitting on them. So that's not allowed. So this, so the question is, what would be the rationale? What would be the rationale against acting disrespectfully toward human remains? What do you say?
Well, Hashem created you, and it belongs to Him.
Okay.
And you should be disrespectful. Right?
Yeah, that's valid. Anything else? I mean, this one I would say is definitely the dominant one, but there's another component where a person has an interest that that his remains should just be handled with respect. Nobody likes to be abused when they're alive. They wouldn't want to be abused when they're not alive. So they shouldn't be mistreated. But then comes the second argument, as noted, more based on religious teachings, that it's a sacred entity, and therefore it should not be mistreated. So the first one is not because of sanctity; it's just because of humanity. just because a human shouldn't be mistreated, not when they're alive and not when they're not alive. The second thing is a sanctity. The body actually has a sanctity and therefore should not be mistreated. So these are the two arguments, and the reason for that is, of course, is because the sanctity of the body, as noted, every human being is created in the image of God, and we'll have a little bit more about that a little later in this discussion tonight. And most importantly, the only way the soul is able to carry out its mission here on earth is through the body and with the body. We can't do any good deed. A soul without a body can't do anything good in this world. It needs the body. So because this individual lived, hopefully, to a ripe old age and carried out its mission with this body, so this body takes on a sanctity of its own. Even now when the soul departs from the body still holds on to that sanctity. It doesn't go away. Holiness doesn't depart from a place where it is. Because it was there, because it was a container for the soul throughout its life, therefore that sanctity remains even now. So however we understand it, it's clear that the Talmud is telling us that you can't desecrate, you can't mistreat a body, and therefore it's forbidden to ride on top of human bones. If that's the case, it certainly would be considered a desecration to cut into a human body and to dissect a human body. So that's clear from that Talmudic teaching that we just read. The question is, are there any exceptions to this rule? It's clear what the rule would be. The question is, to what extent? So we're going to generally be studying two different approaches to this tonight, and we'll introduce our first one, which is going to be based on a question that came to a 19th century German rabbi named Yaakov Ettlinger. We'll refer to him as the Ettlinger approach tonight. Did we meet him yet, this course? Maybe not. I don't think we shared anything, certainly not from the main teachings yet in this course. But anyway, so we'll meet this rabbi tonight, and we'll start with a reading from his works. Colin, if you are okay, please reading for us text number 2 on page 124 in English.
I was consulted regarding a case of a patient who was ill with a unique disease. Doctor treated him, but to no avail. He died of his illness. Another patient suffered the same illness, and the doctor sought to dissect the body of the deceased person to understand the disease and possibly find a cure for the patient who was still alive. Under such circumstances, is it permissible to desecrate the dead?
Okay, so that's the question. And it's important to remember the specifics, because we're going to have other cases here, other questions. But in this case, the question that came to Rabbi Ettlinger was that one patient died of an illness, but there was another patient that suffered from the same illness. And now the question was, if they can get insight from this case through dissecting this body, to apply it to another case that was an active case of someone else who had the same illness. That was the question that came to him. So, the question assumes that cutting into a body is forbidden because of what we said would be an act of desecration. So, nonetheless, the questioner is wanting to know, what are the limits of this prohibition? It's a given that it's prohibited. The question is, if in this case, basically, we have a scenario of saving a life. We want to save a life of the second patient in this discussion. The question is, are you able to dissect the body of patient A in order to potentially save the life of patient B? So, what do you say, for starters?
My gut instinct is yes.
To save a life, okay. Anybody disagree? You say no.
That assumes that you're going to find a cure.
Well, it's possible. It's remote, but it's possible. So, we know this rule, and we already spoke about it in previous lessons in this course, that when it comes to a threat to someone's life, almost all of Jewish law is suspended in order to save a life. So, of course, the big one, which we've discussed, is you can violate Shabbat. Shabbat is extremely sacred in Judaism, of course, but yet you can violate it if there's a threat to somebody's life. We talked about the scenario, if somebody's stuck under rubble, you know, Surfside, Florida, just a few years ago. Very unfortunate situation, a lot of Jewish people. So over there was a very real question, and of course you can, and not only you have to. You have to do whatever you can to try to save somebody's life. And even if it's a question or a doubt, what's that?
This case is different because this is performing an autopsy so that you might be able to.
That's still okay. Even if you're not sure, if you're trying to get somebody out of the rubble, but there's a 90% chance that he's gone already, you still violate Shabbat for the small chance. I'm saying 90%, but it's any chance. Any chance to save the life, then you do it. Shabbat is suspended. So the question here is, yes, we would violate almost all of Judaism to save a life. The question is, would you do so and dissect this body of patient A in order to potentially save patient B? That's the question that came to Rabbi Etlinger, and this is what you would think his answer would be, based on this principle that we know, that you violate anything for the sake of saving a life, you would think that that's what you would do. However, Rabbi Etlinger argues that it's not the case. That it's not the case, in his opinion. And to make his point, he kind of brings up another topic. It gets a little bit Talmudic here, but we have a brilliant group here, so I'm sure you'll do well through this little journey here. So here's the question. The question is, the bigger question that he brings up, or I shouldn't say bigger, but another question that he brings up, is if somebody's life is in danger, and the only way to save your life is by stealing something from somebody else. Are you allowed to steal from somebody to save your life? If you're drowning and you could steal somebody's boat, are you allowed to do that? If, unfortunately, somebody in your family is suffering from an illness and the answer is in the pharmacy around the corner, but they're closed, could you break in to get what you need to save a life? I have a no right here. Who else?
Yes. I'm sorry, I would do
yes.
it.
Yes, you would do it.
To save one of my children, and
it's not a... I don't know anyone who won't. The question is if you're allowed to.
No.
You say no, okay. So far we got a yes here,
a yes.
And two no's, yes. And a yes. Anybody else? Len, how are you getting away without expressing opinions?
Thank you.
Okay, so let's take a look at text number 3, and let's see what he has to say. Well, this is not the same rabbi, but he's quoting from the precursor to the Code of Jewish Law. Joyce, please, text 3.
Nothing stands in the way of saving a life. Nevertheless, if people are in mortal danger and must steal from their fellows in order to save their lives, it is forbidden for them to do so without intention to repay.
Okay, here's an important caveat there, the last 3 words. So, yes, you're allowed to steal to save a life. You're allowed to violate every law in Judaism. However, you could only do so if you have the intention to repay the person when you'll be able to. Even if right now you're an extremely poor individual, but if you have the intention to do so, even if you'll be paying them back for the rest of your life, as long as you want to do so, then yes. Helen.
I mean, your example about the pharmacy is an interesting one. Yes, you would break into the pharmacy to get what you need that you know will save a life. That doesn't mean you don't have the intention to repay them. It just means they were closed at the time that you needed.
Then you can do it.
I mean,
then Jewish law will endorse what you're doing as long as it's...
I guess what I'm saying is I don't think you should assume that somebody wouldn't have had the intention to repay. the circumstances.
All of us here in this room with this scenario, you're right. But sometimes somebody could whatever, maybe.
How can you repay the body?
Yeah, that was my question.
I knew we have Talmudic scholars in the room here. Yes, Lou?
How is this different than an organ transplant? How do you repay someone who donates an organ, either after they pass or even while they're still alive, kidney transplant, for example?
Transplant is another, it's obviously...
But are you stealing?
No, because they consent.
Yeah, in most scenarios, they consent. Although it's a very related topic, but we're going to hold off on transplant for now, just so, because we could do a whole class on it, and it's not the topic tonight, but maybe we'll touch on it a little bit later on when we get through what we need to.
You're going to bypass it? It's a bad joke. I couldn't help myself.
We have a cardiac surgeon here.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So let's put on our Talmudic thinking caps here. So we have this teaching that's on the screen where you're allowed to do the stealing to save a life, but as long as it's with the intention of repaying. So what is the rationale for insisting on an intention to reimburse when theft is critical to saving a life? Why should we be so set on that you have to repay? I mean, is somebody in danger? Why is that intention necessary? Oh, yeah, but so is Shabbat observance. And you don't have to think about the fact that I'm going to observe Shabbat next week or somehow I'm going to make up this one that I'm violating. It's not necessary. There's a life at stake. You do what you need to do.
Because you're hurting another person. You could hurt the owner of the pharmacy. Maybe they're very poor as well.
Excellent. Okay, so that's one rationale for sure. First one is, thank you, Nick, one cannot save their own life by hurting another. So it's very nice that you have to save a life, but you're hurting someone else. You're inflicting some type of injury on another person, even if it's financial loss, for your sake. And you can't do that. And number two, when violating a rule, we take the minimalist route. Let me just explain this a little bit. So when we, let's just say, I'm going to go back to Shabbat. So a life is that's in danger, and you have to violate Shabbat in order to save that person. So we don't just say, well, now that you're violating Shabbat, just do whatever. Now, the priority, of course, has to be to save the life, and you do whatever is necessary. But even when you're doing whatever is necessary, you still do your best to take the minimalist approach. You don't just violate for fun, you know, without thinking to go all the way. If you can get by to do whatever you need to do by violating Shabbat to one degree, then it's not necessary to go to a second or third degree. Now, nobody's suggesting to do anything, don't compromise on anything you need to do to save the life. That's a given. But once you have that mindset, you don't just go all the way. You try to do the least possible because at the end of the day, you're violating Shabbat. So you do it to the degree necessary, but not beyond that. So
you had an example of that with on October 7th. There were all these guys with United Hatzalah who are religious in Israel. And they got the call and they would... I saw a short documentary on this on the Israeli network where they got the call on their phone, and so they knew they were going to like Kibbutz Be'eri. So then they turned their phone off. So they didn't know all this, these terrorists were there. They didn't know people were shooting at them because they just went. But they didn't continue. They didn't listen to the radio. They didn't, you know, they turned their phone off. They got their mission. And then they did the very minimalist to do it.
Yes. You know. Well, in their case, they probably should have left their phone on because at every moment life's at stake. But the concept of not just once you're doing it, then also listen to the radio and also this, maybe it wasn't necessary to listen to the radio. Maybe their phone on was necessary, and we'll come back to this a little later a little bit as well. So anyway, here are the two possible answers to the question of what the rationale might be of why for insisting on the intention of paying back when you're stealing to save a life. So coming back to the Ettlinger approach. So he takes the first view, and we'll see soon how the majority of rabbis do not agree with Ettlinger, and they take a different approach, but for now we're talking Ettlinger, so let's stick with him. And he takes the first approach, that you can't save your life by inflicting injury on somebody else, or you're hurting somebody else. I don't mean bodily injury, but you're hurting someone else. You're stealing from them, and you're saving your own life. So he follows this approach. You can't do that. Now, how does he explain himself? This happens often. If you want, you can switch the light over there. But it stays off for like 2 minutes and then goes back on. But if you want to try switching it off and on, you're more than welcome. This is life at the shul here. Okay, thank you. So, thank you. So he explains like this. How does he come to the conclusion that in general you're allowed to violate Jewish law to save a life? So there's a verse that says that you will keep my decrees and laws, etc. But then it says at the end of that verse, in Hebrew it's v'chai bahem, which means that you will live in them. Because that verse of keeping my commandments ends with those words, and you shall live by them, the sages learn from that that you follow the mitzvahs and God's commandments as long as you are living by them. But if someone's life is at stake, then you violate the law. That's the source for it. So Ettlinger learns from this verse, being that it says my commandments, so he learns that violating Jewish law in order to save a life only extends to commandments that are considered within the category of between man and God commandments, not the ones that are between man and man. So Shabbat, for example, which one is that? Between man and God. If I violate Shabbat, God forbid, I'm not hurting anybody. I'm compromising my relationship with God. That's it. But if I violate do not steal from another, obviously, that falls into the category of between man and man. So Rabbi Ettlinger says that the commandments that could be violated to save a life are only the ones that are between man and God. But I can't go and hurt somebody else in order to save my life. I have no business doing that. So based on this, this is why he says that when it comes to stealing, I have to have the intention of paying the guy back. But if I don't have that intention, I have no business stealing from him in order to save my life. It's necessary to have that intention, and then, being that the other person won't get hurt, certainly not in the long term, that's why it's okay to do that stealing. So he sees this as grounds to forbid dissecting the body as well. Let's come back to him in text number 4. You read already, Joyce? So Nick, please.
It is stated explicitly that it is forbidden to steal to save a life if one has no intention to repay. In the present case, it is impossible to repay, inasmuch as one cannot compensate the deceased for having it desecrated. It is therefore forbidden to save a life through the desecration of the deceased.
Thank you very much. And I believe this was stated by somebody before, that being that in this case, it's not possible to repay the person, therefore, it's not okay to dissect their body, because if comparing it to the case of stealing, I need to have that intention to repay them, and then it becomes okay to hurt them in the here and now. But in this case, I'm going to dissect this body to save another person's life. How am I ever going to repay this patient A? There's no way to repay them. And if that's the case, I'm not allowed to dissect their body, even if it's to save a life of another person. Did you have a question?
Can one assume that the person who is deceased was knowledgeable enough in Torah that he or she would have consented in order to save a life?
Just an assumption in every scenario? No, because there's no way to know that. There's no way to make that assumption. There's a specific scenario where you could say, like, if somebody was a victim of murder, then it's very likely that they would agree to have their body dissected if it will help catch their murderer.
That's interesting.
So that, in all likelihood, most people, maybe almost everybody, would be okay with that. So you could assume that. But just to say in every case that they would want to do so, no, we have no business saying that.
But if the wife consents that she did the murder, then you don't have to do the other.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. So here's the next interesting turn. So Rabbi Ettlinger is closing the door with one hand, but he's opening a door at the same time. He closed the door to say that because you can't pay this person back, so there's no way to just say that you can dissect their body. But at the same time, he's opening a door that as long as a person gave their consent in advance, then he is okay 100% of the time. As long as somebody was asked and they gave their consent, then it is totally okay. So with permission, he sees the issue. In Hebrew, it's called nivul. It means like the desecration. Nivul in Hebrew means to desecrate or disgrace. So he sees that once the person gave their consent, that overrides the potential desecration of the body, and therefore he would say it's okay, even if there's no life that needs to be saved through dissecting the body. As long as somebody gave their consent, then he's okay with it.
Can a family member give consent?
Well,
it
probably depends which approach you take. A family member can't just decide for somebody else unless they somehow prove that this person gave consent. But if the person didn't give consent, a family member should just make a decision assuming that they agreed to something or that they would like something. It's a very serious thing, this. This is not just it's not a flippant thing that as long as you have somebody to say the yes on their behalf, then it's okay. So as long as that person himself consented, Rabbi Ettlinger, who we're discussing so far, I don't see why somebody else would be able to make the decision on their behalf.
I can tell you a lot of times I've been in that situation. Someone's really sick, so they're not, let's say they're comatose.
Yeah.
And you want the autopsy so you can figure out what's wrong with them. But you didn't know what was wrong with the sick patient. Hmm. So you want to find out. He can't give consent. You go to the next kin for the consent.
Right. But that doesn't mean that that's the case in Jewish law, as we've seen in previous classes.
That is very common. I mean, it's really common.
It's certainly common that when it comes, as we discussed in previous lessons, that when it comes to decisions that need to be made, that yes, the family member or the next of kin is the one to be turned to. But Jewish law forbids autopsy as a rule. I already mentioned, but we'll still see that even though Ettlinger okays it with consent, he's the minority opinion. He's not the mainstream opinion, as we'll see. So the approach is that not. So I don't see why somebody else should be able to. Now, if there is an extenuating circumstance that Jewish law would be okay with it, as we'll see, or even according to Ettlinger, if he gave consent, that family member could be the one to say that he asked for it or requested it and give the okay, but they're doing it essentially on behalf of the person, of their loved one. All right, let's just kind of sum up what we did so far. What do we have here? So Rabbi Ettlinger so far, he says, he goes with option A, that one cannot save their own life by hurting another, his approach, the Ettlinger approach, is the theft theory. One may not hurt their fellow in order to save a life, and desecrating a corpse is worse than theft because there is no repayment, as we noted. So this will just sum up everything we said up until now, that in his approach, when it comes to saving a life, if the deceased consented, then it may be performed. And if it's not to save a life, he'll still say it could be performed as long as there's consent. But if there's no consent, then it may not be performed regardless of if it's to save a life or not to save a life. So this brings us to the end of Rabbi Ettlinger's approach, who followed, as we called it, the theft theory, right? Is that what we called it? The theft theory. Okay. By the way, we mentioned the scenario, maybe it was last week, where if a woman is about to give birth and she's struggling, then and she's basically dying, so you do what you have to do to save the fetus. The reason why you're allowed to do that, in the words of the law that we quoted from Jewish law, was that you cut her open in order to save the fetus. The argument would be exactly this. Because essentially, why would you be able to cut her open? But it certainly would be her will. If she knew she would be in this situation, she would certainly agree to do whatever it takes to save her her fetus about to be born. Okay, let's move along here. Any quick questions or comments? All right. So, Rabbi Ettlinger's theft theory is not the dominant theory, as we said, when it comes to halachic literature. The more dominant opinion is that of Rabbi Yecheskel Landau, who was an 18th century rabbi of Prague, where Colin just came back from. And he, Rabbi Landau, disagrees with the position advanced by Rabbi Ettlinger. And Rabbi Landau was asked about another question, which actually came from London. It came from the London Jewish community. And over there, an individual fell ill with bladder stones. And the physician performed a surgery to remove them, lithotomy, and in the process of this surgery, unfortunately, the patient died and did not survive. So the rabbis from London were asking Rabbi Landau of Prague, is it permitted to dissect the deceased, the body, in the relevant area, in order to learn how to better deal with similar cases? Obviously, this is several hundred years ago, and they were trying to figure out how to better their knowledge and their skills in this area of medicine. The question was, could they dissect this body in order to gain knowledge so that if similar cases emerge, they should be better equipped to deal with them? Basically, the key word here is potential life-saving value from this dissection. So the question is similar to the one that Rabbi Ettlinger got, but there's a difference also. Over there, the question was, could you dissect the body to be able to help another patient who had the same thing already? There was a present situation. However, the question that Rabbi Landau got was just to have knowledge in general for potential future cases, but there wasn't one yet on the table. So, Rabbi Landau responded to them. Of course, he first cited what the Jewish law says, that all of Jewish law, besides for the three big cardinal sins, are all violated for the sake of saving a life. So, and you would think that that would be the same thing here as well. But here too, Rabbi Landau stopped short of allowing it. And let's read what he had to say. Eloise, if you can please read text number 5 for us.
It is clearly established law that we must override the Shabbat laws in our attempt to save a life, even if the chance of success is doubtful. However, this is true only if there is a present threat to life before us, as in the case of an ill person or a collapsed building. But in this case, there is no current patient who would immediately benefit from this dissection.
Rather, the physicians want to learn about this surgery because they might in the future encounter a patient who will require it. Certainly, we cannot override a prohibition for this lesser concern. Keep going.
Yeah.
For if we were to indeed consider this a case of life and death, it would follow that all forbidden labors on Shabbat would be permitted if they have any medical benefit. Even if no one were currently ill, it would be permitted. Grind and cook medicines, prepare a knife for bloodletting because of the mere possibility that during Shabbat or immediately afterwards someone will fall deadly ill and require mistakes. If we are permissive about dissection, they will dissect all of our dead simply to study anatomy and how we know how to treat the living.
Thank you very much. So Rabbi Landau is making a very important point. Yes, he says that you can do whatever is necessary to save a life, but that is if there is an actual, clear, and present danger to someone's life. In the Hebrew, he calls this pikuach nefesh, but the key word is lifanenu. So he goes with the sanctity theory, and that's the key word here. Pikuach nefesh means a life is in danger. That term we've been using a lot. The new word here of Rabbi Landau is lifanenu, which means a clear and present danger to life. So yes, he would agree that you should do that. In the other case, where there was something where knowledge and experience was needed for the here and now of a patient before us. But the question that he got was with no patient before them, and therefore he said that would not be okay. Because if you could do it just based on a potential issue, then where do you draw the line? I mean, drive to the beach on Yom Kippur and stay there all day because somebody may drown and that you'll have to save their life. So it doesn't. There's nowhere to draw the line, and therefore, unless it's real and present, then he would not allow it. So those are the two approaches: first the theft theory, and then the sanctity theory. Can you detect significant distinctions between the respective decisions of Rabbi Landau and Rabbi Ettlinger? Anybody? So let's take a look. So we have two big issues here, two significant differences. Number one is the definition of desecration. The sanctity theory, which was Rabbi Landau, who we just said, he says that a person has no right to allow their body to be desecrated. The sanctity theory argues...
So I have a question.
Yes.
Bothered me for a half hour now. Is a dead person a person?
What does that mean? They're a body with...
No. You're the rabbi. No, what I mean is there is a sense that a dead person has rights.
Definitely.
Okay. That's what I'm asking.
Yes, but... We touched upon it already, and we'll be adding more to that discussion tonight, actually very shortly. It's not just a vessel that was. There's something to it right now. No,
soul.
It's not a full human. And I mean, there's a lot of components to it. Just the body, once the soul leaves the body, a person's mission here on earth is completed. And there's no obligations on a body. A body doesn't have obligations. We have obligations of how we need to treat the body because of sanctity that it still has.
It has rights then.
It's not that, it has rights.
Read what it says on the slide.
A person has no right to allow their body to be desecrated. So somebody can't make a decision to say in their lifetime that I give consent to...
That I understand.
So they have rights when they're alive, but they can't say when they're alive that this should happen to them when they're not.
Okay.
Versus the theft theory, which was Rabbi Ettlinger, one's right to their body remains after death. Unwarranted desecration is worse than theft, as we noted, because it's to the person themselves. Theft is just a person's possession. This is the person themselves. So being that Len kind of mentioned it, and we're actually venturing right into this, so actually, let me finish. Within the second distinction between these two rabbis and their approaches, we have another very important factor. And that is that what is the reason why it's prohibited to desecrate a body? So according to Jewish thinking, to answer your question, a corpse is a sacred entity. It's not a person, but it's a sacred entity. We already read in the opening text, which I believe you read, that you can't mistreat human bones by writing. What does it say right after that, in that teaching, which we didn't quote yet, but we're quoting it now, in text 6a, another few words, which I'll read. Just as human bones must be handled respectfully, so must a Torah scroll. That's what follows. Meaning if you're transporting a Torah scroll, you can't just mistreat it and put it down and sit on it. Just like you can't mistreat those human remains, you can't mistreat a Torah scroll. Is a Torah scroll a person? Absolutely not. Is it something that has sanctity? 100%. And these two are compared and therefore can't be mistreated. Now, why would we compare specifically these two things? I mean, obviously, they're both sacred. But still, there's other sacred objects. A mezuzah is sacred. Tefillin are sacred. And when we say that they're sacred, it means a mitzvah is done with something and it literally becomes holy and we can't mistreat it. You can't just store your tefillin on the floor because it's convenient to put them on the floor because you're moving or whatever. It needs to be treated with respect. So why are we comparing the body specifically to a Torah? So that's what 6b tells us. Nachmanides points to the sacred names of God that are inked onto to a Torah scroll's parchment as an analogy for the sacred soul that is installed within the corporeal body. So we have two components when it comes to a human, two components when it comes to a Torah scroll. A Torah scroll is written on parchment, and this parchment is just animal hide, and it could have ended up being a pair of shoes also. Instead, it ended up being a Torah scroll. Now, when it became a Torah scroll, what is inked onto this parchment? Of course, the words of Torah, but most importantly among them is the name of God. When the name of God is inked on a parchment, the parchment is no longer just another piece of animal hide. Now it's something sacred that needs to be treated with respect, and that's why there's an ark in front of the synagogue where it's placed and it's given its the reverence that it deserves, and that's required. So the body and soul component is like the parchment and the names of God that are written on the parchment. The parchment is the body. The names of God are like the soul of the Torah scroll. So we're using that analogy to say that that the body, just like the parchment, now becomes holy, even though it's just parchment. And even if you can't use the Torah anymore, let's just say it's disqualified and there are letters that are faded and you can't use it for a public reading anymore, bless you. Nonetheless, it's still holy. You still keep them in the ark, even if they're not being used anymore, because the respect, the sanctity doesn't go away. The same is with the body. The body maintains the sanctity even after the soul departs from it, and that's why it's called for. That's why this whole approach and sanctity theory exists, because that respect needs to continue. Important text, actually. Let's read text number 7. Lou, are you okay?
Yeah.
Please.
So. The rationale underlying the regulation mandating respect for the dead is a Talmudic parable concerning a pair of twins. One of the twins grows to adulthood and is crowned king of the realm. The second becomes a highwayman and is apprehended and executed as punishment for his crimes. Suppose then, we are told, the body of the executed twin was placed on public display. Would not passers-by scrutinize the body and, perceiving what they believe to be the familiar countenance of their ruler, assume that it is none other than the king himself who has been punished so ignominiously? Man is created in the image of God, with the result that, however the anthropomorphic term is to be understood, human body reflects an aura of divinity just as the king is dishonored in the indignity meted out to his twin, God is dishonored in the dishonor of the divine image associated with the human body.
Thank you very much. So what is this telling us? This is all Rabbi Landau's approach, and that is the sanctity theory, that we are not owners of our bodies. We touched upon this in earlier lessons, and we are granted certain rights over our bodies, but we can't. And this is a very big change from the previous approach. Rabbi Landau was saying that we don't have the right to consent for our own body to be desecrated. Never mind the next of kin. In our own lifetime, we can't make a decision that our body should be desecrated because it's not ours, and it also carries the image of God. And therefore, we have to think about what God says, because it's in His image and His ownership too. We're just given a deposit. And therefore, He forbids any desecration of a corpse, consent notwithstanding. So that's a big change. However, there is one exception, as we already noted, and that is if there's a clear and present danger to a life and that this could save, so yes, even he will agree that that is overridden.
So, really, in the three examples we've had, the first was the case of the dissection for anatomy, learning anatomy, and the issue was whether they had consent or not. Both Landau and Eplinger would say no. There's no one with obvious...
You mean the case study?
The case
study. Yeah, we'll return to it.
And then the next scenario is when the doctor thought maybe if he dissects the prior patient who died, he would help. There's clear and present danger to another one with similar disease. So Landau would say yes.
Mm-hmm.
Eplinger would actually say no.
Depending on consent.
So
if there's no consent.
The consent is the main issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then this last scenario where you're just going to dissect to learn for the profession as opposed to any specific danger, they'd both say no.
Well, Eplinger, if there was consent, even if there isn't a life at stake right now, well, if it's going to be used, if it's the case study, Eplinger would still say no. And we'll come back to this once we have all the information. But if it's to use to potentially save a life, even if it's not clear and present, Eplinger would say yes, with consent. Okay, so the second difference between the two is that, we kind of just already articulated it, thanks to your question, and that is if another patient would be present who needed to undergo the same procedure, then Landau would define the situation as clear and present, and therefore he would say, even though he's generally no on everything, if it was clear and present, he would say yes. Okay, let's just kind of sum this up. I believe we can get the help of our screen here. So we talked about the Torah analogy: the human body gains permanent sanctity as it was once the vehicle for the sacred soul, and it's not ours to desecrate. The significant differences when it comes to saving a life. So the sanctity theory of Landau would be that any prohibition is suspended, including desecration, when it comes to saving a life. The theft theory would say that saving a life doesn't override lack of consent. Okay. Of course, we have the three big ones, which you do not violate even if a life is in danger. So just to sum it up with this chart, Rabbi Landau, and this will help you, Octavia, your question. So if it's to save a life and there was consent, then it could be performed. And if there was no consent, then it still could be performed according to Rabbi Landau, but if it's not to save a life, then it may not be performed. Clear?
That will be acceptable.
What is it?
Keep going.
Okay. One thing that still remains undone, we said in Rabbi Landau's opinion that there needs to be a clear and present danger to a life in order to dissect another life, another body. The question is, what does clear and present mean? Does it mean it has to be right here and right now, or is there a little bit more of a broader spectrum to that? So this is an important question. So say, for example, if somebody, if a person with cancer dies after receiving an experimental treatment. So in that case, you would want to know what exactly didn't work in order to know how to go about using this new treatment for the next patient. In that case, everybody would agree that you are allowed to dissect because that's called clear and present. This is a new treatment. We don't know. And for other patients that may be utilizing the same treatment, you would need to know. Another example, and it's before my times, but there was a convention in Philadelphia in 1976, American Legion Convention, and a few hundred people fell ill at this convention. Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay. So it was like a pneumonia-like disease. A lot of people were dying, and a lot more people were in danger of dying, and they didn't really know what it is. So in a scenario like that, it would certainly be okay to perform an autopsy to be able to discover what went wrong and the treatment that could save the life of other patients. Now, obviously, it's not reasonable to argue that the patient who is the potential or the clear and present patient that needs the insight from what we're trying to glean from dissecting patient A doesn't have to be literally at hand. That patient may be in a different state, maybe even in a different country. But if there's information that could be utilized for a clear and present danger, then that will be that will work. That will be okay. Another scenario would be, let's just say multiple patients suddenly start dying during appendectomies, let's say. So, of course, it's a surgery that's performed on thousands of patients, and suddenly people are dying in the surgery. So the question here is if something is very common and happens a lot, meaning a certain surgery is done a lot. Right now, some issue came up, and we're trying to figure out what happened. Now, what if, so the question is, could you dissect a body in a scenario where you don't have a here and now clear and present patient who needs to know the information that we're trying to glean right now? So in a scenario like this, the point we're getting to is that even if there isn't a clear and present patient in the here and now, being that it's something that's so common, you can basically be certain that there will be a patient that will need this information in the very near future. And therefore, most rabbis will say, or they'll argue that Rabbi Landau would consider that to be a clear and present case before them. Maybe we won't read the whole text A, but it just makes this point. Feel free to read it after the class. But the main point that text makes is that as long as there's a statistical probability of additional patients needing it, and something like the appendectomy, which is something that's extremely common, even if there isn't one before us right now, today, but you know that in the very near future there will be, in that case, they may argue that it would be okay to dissect. Okay. All right, so what defines saving a life? a presently ill patient, certainly the strong probability of a future danger. Okay, another point. When it comes to autopsies that are non-invasive procedures, so those being that they are not, so according to both rabbis, it seems, you could argue that being that it isn't an outright desecration, being that it's non-invasive, so they're likely to permit certain procedures that are a little bit more, let's just say, innocent and don't and wouldn't fall into the category of desecration or disgracing the body. Here we also have a text from Rabbi Feinstein, who we did quote, I believe, in all of the three previous classes. Helen, would you be okay reading text number 9, please?
Sure. In my opinion, it would not constitute a violation of nebuah, desecration, if physicians will not cut open the limbs, neck, or torso, but only seek to perform a needle biopsy in order to obtain fluid for diagnostic analysis and evaluation. It is not a form of desecration and is permissible because it is very common to do such procedures on the living. Likewise, removing blood via needle and syringe for analysis does not constitute desecration and is permitted. Although I have not found this stated explicitly in earlier sources, it seems clear to me that this is true.
Thank you very much. So This contributes to the idea of non-invasive. A couple of rabbis, Rabbi Orbach, who we quoted once before, and Eliashiv ruled that practicing intubation on a cadaver did not constitute nivul, which means desecration, because it's a procedure that's done on the living. I know some of these things lack some definition, and yes, there's different rabbis with different opinions, but there definitely is room to be okay with things like this. Another recent development, which would be wonderful if it became more and more popular, maybe the doctors in the room know a little bit more about this, but what's called virtual autopsies. And it seems that nowadays, more recently, autopsies are being done virtopsy, like through MRIs or other ways, without actually having to open the body or actually dissect. So this would be a very, very good substitute or alternative in Jewish law, based on everything that we discussed so far. So it seems like it's more of a recent thing. It may not be so across the board yet, but it would definitely be something that the Jewish community should support, because it would be very helpful for all of this. Okay, so the non-invasive, even if no consent was given and no present life is at stake, that we mentioned, and the key idea here is this, and we'll spend a lot of our remaining time on this. And then after that, we'll close with a short video. So here's the key component here. So we've been talking about nivul, which means desecration. We talked about if there's permission. We talked about clear and present danger and non-invasive procedures. But it's not this issue is not the only issue. There's another issue which comes up, and it's a very important issue when it comes to the question of autopsy, in addition to desecration. And that has to do with the value in Judaism called Jewish burial. Because as we know, burial is a mitzvah, literally a commandment in the Torah, certainly according to Maimonides, to bury, and specifically in the ground. And we'll show some sources for that in a moment. But the Torah itself tells us how Abraham went and purchased a plot of land in Hebron, where I was just about 2 months ago. And by the way, we're hosting a rabbi from Hebron in 2 weeks on June 28th. He's spending Shabbat with us. He lives in Hebron for 22 years, but more on that another time. And that place, which is one of the four locations, can't help it once you mention it. Hebron is one of the four locations in the Holy Land that the transaction of their purchase is recorded in the Torah. And guess which four locations in Israel are the most contested? The ones that their transaction of purchase by Jews is recorded in the Torah. But this too is for another time. So Abraham went and purchased this plot of land. And he went so far and went a distance, not necessarily geographically, but the whole conversation and discussion is recorded in the book of Genesis. And he paid top dollar for it, etc. Why? In order to fulfill this Torah obligation. And the Midrash tells us that God himself was involved in the burial of Moses. And we don't know the burial place of Moses until today. So let's see what text 11 says. Lauren, please. A very, very powerful statement, because just as an introduction, generally speaking, when it comes to fulfilling the wishes of somebody who passed away, Judaism says that it's a very important value, and it's a commandment, an obligation, to fulfill the wishes of somebody who passed on, and all their wishes. But you may be surprised that there's one exception to that. If they said something on what you'll read now, and we don't listen to them, go ahead.
If the deceased had instructed that they not be buried after their death, we do not obey, because we are commanded to bury our dead, as the verse states, you shall bury them on the same day.
Thank you. So it's an actual Torah commandment, and we actually don't listen to them. And we'll still come back to this, maybe a drop, but nowadays there's a pandemic, we can call it, of people choosing cremation. In the vast majority of cases, it's a decision that people are making without, it's not really an educated decision. They're just making the decision based on other factors. But if they would be aware of what the Jewish position on it is, and obviously it's the worst thing that could be done to a Jewish body, they wouldn't be choosing it. And if someone does choose it, then we even go against their will to undo it after they're gone, and see to it that they should have a Jewish burial. That's how important it is. And I've been part of conversations in many scenarios where somebody left such a desire, and the family is left with grappling with this decision. Sometimes some family members want to support it and some don't. A lot of problems could emerge. So it's very important to educate people. Education is key, and people need to know about this and how important burial is in Judaism and Jewish law, and to such an extent that we even violate their will. By the way, the reason why we don't listen to them in this case is because right now, after their soul departs and is now in heaven, and is in a world of truth, where they are right now, they absolutely wouldn't choose cremation. They would choose the right decision. So when we actually are burying them now, we're actually fulfilling their will from where they are right now. Even though when they were still here in a body, they may not have been equipped and had the tools to make the right decision. So the key here is burial, and how important and central a mitzvah it is. And as we mentioned before, the whole idea of the human being and the human body is that we are just a custodian of this body. It was given to us by God, and we have to return it. And the day when it arrives, in its time, when the custodian needs to return the deposit, so what happens? God takes the soul. God gave the soul, he takes back the soul. But he leaves the job to us to make sure that the right thing is done with our body that he gave us. So as long as we're around, we're able to give instructions what should be done. But otherwise, it's those who are closest to the loved ones or next of kin who have the task to make sure that this person finds their final resting place as is stipulated by God in his Torah. Now, in theory, if there would be a way to return the body to God, that's what we would do. But obviously you can't do that. So how do you return the body to God? We, so to speak, ask God what he wants us to do with the body. And we know exactly what he wants us to do with the body, as we read in text number 12. Ori, I don't know if we had you yet.
For you were made from dust, and to dust you will return. The human body was created from the earth, and our bodies are handed to us as a deposit. Upon death, the deposit must be returned to the earth, and from where it was taken for burial.
Thank you very much. So that's what God tells us. He formed us from the earth, and that's where exactly where he wants us to be returned. So that's why it is an essential component of Jewish end-of-life matters. Now, when it comes, so that's burial in its own right, which is a big issue when it comes to autopsy. Because burial, first of all, the body needs to be buried. Now, there's one question of it being delayed, which we'll see in a second, but burial applies to every part of the body. And sometimes in an autopsy, it's possible that some body parts may stay behind, even when it's necessary to do what they're doing, but it may compromise the fact that every single part of the body needs to be buried. So, and if anything will stay back, it's halachically problematic. Let's see Octavia number 13, please.
Even those opinions that tend to be more lenient regarding the question of desecrating the dead would agree that there is no permission to provide bodies to the medical schools in Poland. We have done an investigation into the protocols of the prosectorium and have learned that many of the limbs of bodies donated to these medical schools are never buried. Some are scalded, some are stored in containers, and some are branded with numerals. The Jerusalem Talmud, Nazir 7:1, states, when the Torah commands, bury them. It is instructing us to bury the entire corpse. This informs us that if part of the body is left unburied, it is as if no burial has occurred.
Thank you very much. So this addresses the first issue, number one, that the entire body must be buried, which is very important to pay attention to. Now, even if you could ensure that every single body part will be buried, there's another issue. And that is, in a verse that was just quoted, that the dead should be buried on the very day of passing. That's what the Torah says. Now, not always is this possible, but that's the ideal situation. And I know of a few right here in Houston where it was actually able to be fulfilled, and that's ideal. And it's the greatest honor and respect that's possible to be brought to the deceased. But the key component that we take away from that verse is not to delay burial, even if you need to delay somewhat, even if it's going to be the next day, but there needs to be a very strong sense of urgency when scheduling the burial, even if it's not that day. And the key component is that it has to be related to the honor of the deceased. So let's just say somebody wants this, a family wants everybody to be there, for example, and it will take a couple days for people to get there. So there is an argument to say that it's honoring the deceased if all family members will be there. So that's a worthy reason of why to delay it to the next day, but not just to delay it until the weekend or until it's convenient. Things like that are actually a violation of this law. And the reason for that is because after the soul departs, up until burial, the soul is actually in limbo. It's not in the body anymore, of course, but it also doesn't yet go to heaven. It's between heaven and earth, and this is why we rush that phase very much, from the passing until burial, so that we can bring peace to the soul as soon as possible, because as long as we don't, it's not able to begin its journey on high. So the key is, just like when somebody gives us a deposit, we give it back when the time comes without delay. But here's a very important teaching from the Midrash. It's a short one, but an important one. Len, text 14, please.
The dust returns to the earth, as it was at the start of creation, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. When does the spirit return to God who gave it? When the dust returns to the earth as it was.
Thank you. So this midrash actually makes it like dependent, that when does the spirit, the soul, return to God? Only after the body is first buried and returned to the earth. And that's when it happens. So as we noted before, this is another very important source of why cremation should, God forbid, never be considered. And by the way, we all have friends and we all have acquaintances and people just don't know. So if you ever have the opportunity to bring it up in a conversation with a friend in a natural way, if that's possible, a conversation about cremation, but if it could ever come up, it's actually a huge mitzvah for you to enlighten anyone you know about this. As I said, largely it's just an issue about people being ignorant on this topic.
Or stubborn.
What's that?
Or stubborn.
Or stubborn. But
does that apply to Jews and non-Jews?
Well, a lot of what we said here, what we believe could apply to non-Jews as well. Meaning whatever we say about the body and the sanctity of the body replies to non-Jews because it's in the image of God. The question is, if they're mandated, see, Jewish law can't mandate a non-Jew to follow the Torah. A Jew has the obligation. But a non-Jew who's inspired to follow teachings of Judaism, then most certainly it would apply. So that is as far as the process of the spirit returning to God only after the body first returns to the ground. And as we noted, the only justifiable reason to delay this process being that, as I said, the soul is in limbo, would be if it's specifically directly honoring the soul, that would be the only justification. But otherwise, there should be a very strong sense of urgency to get it done ASAP. Yes?
If a body part, such as an arm or leg or anything else, is separated from the rest of the body, how much effort should be expended to try to bury it at the body part at the same location where the body is, or is it okay just to make sure that that body part is buried somewhere?
A lot of effort. So as anything with a bone should be buried together with the body. And if it could be located, sometimes someone has an amputation and then they live after that for a while, so it should be preserved. Another option is, and actually I just heard this story about a soldier in Israel who was injured. He was, forgot the name of the tank, but whatever, he was a tank driver. And he was injured severely, and he had his leg amputated. And this is not a religious guy at all. And when he woke up from the surgery, after his injury, and he was informed that his leg had to be amputated, so the question was, what do you do with it? So they told him the options. And again, this is not a religious guy. But one of the options, he was educated. He was told that in Jewish law, we're buried with our body parts. And so he said, as we know, there are 13 principles of the Jewish faith that Maimonides records. Just like belief in one God, belief in the Torah, one of the 13 is believing in the resurrection of the dead. But after Mashiach comes, all of the dead will be resurrected. And this is, by the way, another very important part, component of why the body is so important in Jewish law, and that's why it has to be buried, because in order for it to be resurrected, if it's destroyed through cremation, then there isn't what to be resurrected. Not that it stays intact when you bury it, but when you follow the Torah process, then the whatever the future holds for the body will then happen, which is part of Jewish belief. Anyway, this soldier was told about this, and he said, if that's the case, then he wants to be buried with his leg. Now, this is a young guy. He said he wants to be buried with his leg so that in the future, at the time of the resurrection, he'll have his leg. Just, simple faith of this soldier. Anyway, So what do, especially when you're that young? So what you do is, or what people do, and what he actually did, was that his family helped him buy a plot, and he actually himself went, and they buried his amputated leg already in the plot that he will eventually be buried in after 120. This just happened in recent months in Israel. So, yes, that's very critical, and thank you for bringing it up. Let's just sum this up on our slides here. So we talked about the entire body must be buried, with it, which is an important consideration when it comes to autopsy. Burial must take place promptly, and sometimes autopsy could delay it for a long time. So even, again, the point here is that even in a case when it's okay to do the autopsy, in those exceptional scenarios that we already discussed, you have to take all these things into consideration to make sure nothing gets lost and that it's not delayed just and lingers for a long time. Okay, so we all parts of the Yerumah, okay, we talked about this already, and a short delay is okay if the deceased requested to etlinger, etc. Coming back to our case study. Case study, should unclaimed bodies be allowed for use for anatomical dissection? What would Landau say? What would Ettlinger say? To our original case study, if unclaimed bodies, instead of the state burying them, for them to be used in the medical schools. Big no. Rabbi Ettlinger, no consent was given. In his view, everything is based on consent, and there's no consent. To Rabbi Landau, there's no urgent life-saving reasons. Remember, he said there has to be a real and clear present life that's being threatened, and here, that doesn't apply. And then you have an issue of parts of the body that are left unburied, and we will close with a short video. I just want to make one more point before the video. Of course, we have to make sure we don't delay too long. And point number 4 is very important. It's actually in text number 16. And that is that especially when it comes to an unclaimed corpse, we have to be even more sensitive. Because we find in Jewish law that the high priest, okay, there was only one high priest in Hebrew called the Kohen Gadol. And he had to stay in the temple at all times. And he had to be ritually pure at all times, because he had to engage with sacred, he had to be in the sacred space of the temple and deal with sacred objects every day. He is not allowed to attend the funeral of anybody, even his closest family. The average Kohen is allowed to 6 family members, no one else. The one Kohen Gadol is not allowed to compromise his purity, which means attend a funeral of anybody. There's one scenario where even the high priest has to get involved, and that is if he's walking down the street and finds a body that's not alive and is just unclaimed and nobody's dealing with. In Hebrew, that's called a mes mitzvah. It's called a mitzvah death, loosely translated. The Kohen Gadol is not allowed to A, keep walking, and B, say, well, I can't contaminate myself and become ritually impure. He himself has to go deal with it. So this is even a greater stringency when it comes to an unclaimed body, because a body that's unclaimed in Judaism is essentially, it becomes all of ours. Because somebody who has loved ones and people are taken care of, okay, so it's defined. Someone who doesn't have that and it's unclaimed, it becomes the responsibility of the entire community. And even the high priest himself has to engage with it and thereby essentially compromise his ritual purity for the sake of that individual. That's how far the Torah and Jewish law go, to even for somebody in the category of unclaimed. So we're going to turn to the video, and then we'll close after the video with one more thought.
Rabbi Elchanan Zon is an internationally recognized expert on Jewish afterlife care. He has directed the Jewish burial of Queens, New York for over 40 years and is the founding director of a national association that supports and guides rabbis and burial services across the U.S. Judaism considers post-mortem care an honorable duty, and Jewish burial societies are reverently called Chevra Kedisha, meaning the Holy Society.
The Chevra Kedisha is that organization in every Jewish community that deals with the people who die and sees that they are taken care of with the greatest respect. Throughout history, these people were the greatest people of their communities. The people involved in Chevra Kedisha were sometimes the rabbis and the greatest and most pious members of the community. The level of respect that will be accorded to this body if it is cared for by a Chevra Kedisha is on a very different level. The care is done with an understanding that the neshama is present. This is not just a body, this is a person. The soul is there, present with us, and concerned to see that its body is treated with care and with the proper tradition. We are all created in the image of God. We are a great being. We're greater than any other creature on earth. And as such, we are deserving of the kavod, of the respect that such a lofty creature requires. And to leave him unburied for any length of time desecrates the name of God. He or she represents the image of God. That is the reason the Torah provides for which we ought to bury people and for which we ought to bury them immediately. We bury treasure. We burn that which is disposable, that which is to be degraded, that which is to be destroyed. That is the respect that the Torah requires, and that is the only option that the Torah really offers for what we do with the disposition of human remains. The body's return to the earth is actually a form of kapara. It's a form of atonement. And that too gives the neshama, gives the soul, the ability to move on to its eternal place, maybe to a higher place. And that too is part of the importance of burial, which is really a gift. It's a gift that God gives us even after we die, allowing us to atone for our sins. We can no longer come to shul on Yom Kippur. We can no longer do mitzvahs. We can no longer give charity. But we can be buried, which in itself is a form of kapara, a form of atonement. What a phenomenal gift. My earliest recollection of death was as a child. There was a Jewish man, he was a landlord, and one of his tenants, who owed him a lot of rent, stabbed him to death. And so I remember as children gathering around this hole in the ground where the Chevra Kedisha with the Burial Society had dug up the earth that was drenched with his blood to bury in his grave. We will break up concrete. We will do anything that is necessary to bury someone. The stories of people in the Holocaust put their lives on the line to see that someone was buried, whether it was in the ghetto or they exposed themselves or whatever it might have been, at potential danger to their lives. Throughout our history, Chura, burial, was so important. Look at what Israel will give up today for the body, not only of a soldier, but anybody. Look at what we would do just to bury blood or tissue that is found in a terrorist attack.
Mentioned we have a breaking news story to tell you about. Apparently a plane has just crashed into the World Trade Center here in New York City. It happened.
I remember 9/11. I remember being in the medical examiner's office the day after. We buried the bodies on condition that should other parts be found subsequently, they would be placed in their grave and we would open the corner of the grave and bury them, sometimes four or five times. Because every part of the human deserves respect and requires the privilege of burial, the respect that burial provides. I received a call from someone who told me that someone in his family lost a dear friend to a car accident. And it was now, I believe, about a year later, and this person suddenly had a dream where this friend who died came to him and said, "Why didn't you bury me?" And he woke up shaken up the next night. It was a recurring dream. And the night after. And finally he went to someone in his family who was a rabbi, and he asked him what to do. So the rabbi pulled me. "Rabbi, what do you think?" I said to him, "Only thing I can think of is anyone checked out the scene of the accident, in this case the car, to see was everything buried, was everything removed." Turned out this car was about to be crushed the next day. It had been held, it was part of a criminal case, and we sent down members of a Chevra Kadisha who cleaned the car, found pieces of bone and tissue and blood, and buried it. The dream stopped.
Okay, definitely heavy to close a course with. So just one final thought, and that is that the Midrash says that were it not for death, we wouldn't know life. And the most important takeaway, of course, not most important, all of this is incredibly important, but in addition to all that, what it teaches us of how to deal with human remains at the end of life, it really informs us what life is. And really inspires us of how we should live our day-to-day life, how we should look at the body, how we should treat our own body, how we should treat somebody else in the image of God, and realize the power that we have, specifically to utilize our body to make a difference in it being a vehicle and container for our soul in carrying out our personal mission right here on earth. And in so doing, with God's help, we'll very soon merit the coming of Mashiach and the resurrection of our dead, God willing, very soon. Amen. Thank you all for joining us for this course, and I believe you could take a look at the screen for next year's courses. The first one, Nurturing Relationships, will be after the High Holidays, and followed by the other two. We hope to see you again soon at another JLI course. Thank you.